Hello and welcome to the November edition of the Organic Gardening Podcast. I'm Fiona Taylor and later on I'll be joined by my colleagues from Garden Organic, Chris Collins and Dr. Anton Rosenfeld. There's no doubt the nights are drawing in, but there's still so much joy to be had from preparing our gardens for winter. In the postbag, we've got questions on reusing old compost, dealing with codling moth, and why it's important not to leave the soil bare at this time of the year. A few weeks ago, we had the pleasure of chatting with Åsa Gregers-Waag, head gardener at the Beth Chatto Gardens. Later on, Åsa takes us on a tour of the gardens and shares how they're designed to promote resilience and withstand climate change by following the late Beth Chatto's mantra of right plant, right place. But before we dive into that, I'd like to thank our sponsor, Viridian Nutrition. Viridian offers award-winning ethical and organic supplements, including vitamins, minerals, herbal oils and balms. I love how they call themselves the vitamin company with an organic heart. Their supplements can be found in over 1,000 specialist health stores across the UK. To learn more, visit viridian-nutrition.com. That's viridian-nutrition.com. And now I'm off to join Chris in the potting shed. Hello, Chris. How are you?
I'm good, Fiona. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very well, thank you. It's been awfully wet, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. And well, we're into that time, aren't we? The dark months are upon us.
Yes, indeed. I know the rivers come up in Worcester and flooded. And
yeah, Worcester's a bit prone to the
It's very prone, very prone. Yeah, it is indeed. Although I'm very, very proud of my potatoes this year.
Are you very good? It's been a good year for potatoes.
Has it? Everywhere else? I didn't know if it was just me.
No, I don't want to take away anything from your potato prowess.
Yes, please don't do that.
But yeah, I certainly I had quite a good crop. I think that cooler weather earlier in the summer, that's kind of in spring, the cooler sort of period seems to have played in their favour, that's for sure.
Well, you see, I had a slightly different scenario because I didn't get mine in till June. And somebody was saying to me, oh, you're a bit late. I said, yes, I know I'm a bit late, but, you know, I'm still going to do it. And I did 2 barrels of Charlotte. This is in June. And then 2 rows of Wilger. The Charlottes have all been absolutely brilliant and I had them all through the last sort of 5-6 weeks. And then the Wilger, well, they're going to see me right through the winter, I reckon, at this rate. They're just amazing.
Yeah, there's nothing like nice fresh potato as well. And they will keep if you store them in cooler conditions, you know, you can kind of keep them for a while as well.
I was going to ask you about that, actually, because it's so prolific that I really would like to store some. And I suppose I was just thinking, you know, brown paper sacks. What would you do?
Well, I would probably, if you've got a garage or somewhere cool, really, because you don't want them to start to eye and shoot, basically. So anywhere where the temperature's quite cool, maybe put them in sand, like I've done, I've said before.
Ah, yes, okay.
Yeah, and just to try and keep them so it doesn't warm up and then they start to sprout.
But yes.
I mean, even they'll last quite a long time in your fridge, really. If you've got a big fridge drawer, you can keep them in there as well. I've got loads of Maris Pipers and they've been sitting there for quite a while. Yeah. I sort of pull them out as I need them, really.
Yeah, I'm determined to furnish my shed with some of my produce, like you do, Chris.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm trying to, you know, copy you. I wanted to just talk about your shed for a minute because I think you tend to traditionally each winter show it a bit of love. What's the plan this year?
It's a bit of brutal love because I'll rip everything out of it.
Take it all apart.
Yeah, I'll take everything out. I've got some really nice stuff to decorate it with. Some old green carpet I'm going to put up and I'll nail it onto the ceiling just to make it look more gardeny that I rescued. But I'll get everything out. I'll oil and clean all my tools, which I do anyway on a regular basis, but I'll give them a good going over. And I'll get the scrubbing brush on them, clean them, and then I'll paint some oil on them just to protect them from getting rusty. I look at all the seeds I've saved. I've got them labelled. They're all in their Tupperware. But I'd also give the place a good sweep out because it all fills with soil and stuff as I'm working away. I just like it ordered. All the tools get hung on the walls. I've got brackets to hang them up as well. So it's all, I like it ordered, basically.
Inspiring to hear you say that, actually, because I think the shed gets hugely neglected, doesn't it, during the season. And, you know, to be able to come back and give it a good old clear out. You know, if you're lucky enough to have a shed, that is, might as well keep it neat and tidy. So we've talked about oiling your tools, cleaning them up, you know, hanging them on your walls, getting them ready. What about sharpening?
Yes, well, I tend to send mine off. My Sacketeers, which are my pride and joy, and I've had them decades, some pairs, a long, long time. They'll get sent off to a professional. They'll give them a clean, sharpen them up, and they'll come back to me in tip-top condition. And that's quite important. They're important tools to me. You know, those are. So that'll certainly be done. That I think that's best handled by someone who's a professional at that sort of game, really. Mm.
And whilst we're on sort of cleaning up, what about pots? Because there's that whole sort of traditional thing of washing pots, but actually, these days, we're sort of hearing that actually it's better to just brush them out dry. What do you do with your pots?
I'd give mine a dip in water, and I do with a brush, and then I'll dry them off. Yeah, I've always just done it that way, really. I don't think it's going to cause any damage if you use water.
Yeah. No, man of tradition.
Well,
I do a bit of both. I've got a fantastic grubbing brush that's kind of made out of, I don't know, something like coconut husk or something. It's one of those kind of brushes, and it gets all those little bits of muck off. And it's not about being clean. It's actually about being healthy, isn't it? And maintaining a healthy workspace.
Yes. Hygiene thing, really, you see. That's kind of how I view it. And I mean, I've got lots of pots, and I don't throw any of them away, and I've got a place to store them. So I'll have a day down there on the lot that where I just wash them all out, make sure they're stacked properly and they're nice and neat for next year.
It's interesting to think about hygiene, because in the past we always used to just leave that to the frost and just go, well, it's okay because the frost will come and kill everything off. And of course now with these warmer, wetter winters, I mean, obviously some listeners will still have frost, but those of us sort of further south, we don't have so many, and certainly not really sharp ones. You might get one or two, but you know, so that has an impact on hygiene, doesn't it?
Well, it certainly has an impact on pests that overwinter. Yes. Like, I've got a really bad whitefly on my Savoy cabbages and some kale and broccoli, and they are absolutely covered in them a few weeks ago. So I need a cold night for them to knock that out, really, because they do take their toll after a while on the plant itself.
So,
and anything like slugs and snails as well, you want a hard frost. You know, if I'm lucky if I see two frosts in North London. So it basically presents me with a whole different set of problems, really.
And how do you resolve those problems?
Well, things like certainly slugs and snails, I try not to give them places where they can congregate, really, where they can all collect. But otherwise, there's not much I can do, really, in many ways, you know. Yeah. And apart from I'll clean up the leaves, anything that's dying or looking ill or sick or yellowing up, I'll try and keep them as tidy as possible.
Yeah, and obviously try and encourage the amphibians into...
Yes, and bird life. We've got hedgehogs on our site, me and my neighbour, so... Okay. I don't know if they'll be out and about, but certainly a bog garden has got frog life in it, so hopefully they'll help as well. And I've got slow worm, which I think help with the keel slug, which is the one that lives under the soil, which is one of my biggest problems. So, yeah, you can only hope by limiting the damage, really.
Yeah, I've never seen a slow worm in my garden. I wish I had. I think they're amazing creatures. I do have a pond, however, so I do see frogs and toads and newts, and I'm often disturbing them. This time of year, what would you recommend in terms of pond care?
Well, certainly, I mean, I'm trying to get not so many leaves build up in it, if you can, protect from leaves, because it'll make the water a bit more acidic. But not a great deal. I make sure the access to the pond, like any slopes you've got, make sure that's all in situ, really. When it comes to plants, I would probably wait a lot bit later in the year before I cut them down, because obviously you're giving cover to wildlife.
Yes, and, of course. Yeah. I do get a lot of leaves in my pond. I will try and get into the regular habit during the month of going down there with my little net and just fishing them out. Yeah. I don't personally like to net the pond because I know how many birds use it.
Yeah.
And it just frightens me to think that they might get caught in
something. That's fair enough. Well, you can also leave a gap out in, you know, like when traditionally, it doesn't happen now in London, but if it froze over, we'd probably knock a corner out so stuff could still drink and get in and out.
Leave a gap in the netting.
You can maybe do that.
And
I think for getting them out, if the fleas fall in, they sink, then probably that's not bad. You'll get a little bit of organic matter built up at the bottom of the pond. But I would just use a back-to-front springbok or lawn rake and just scoop them out with that, and then they can just go on to the compost bin.
Right. And talking of lawn rakes, very good. Like what you did there, Chris, because I wanted to ask you about lawns, and my one is somewhat rewilded, my lawn, I have to say, which is fine in some ways, but I've got a lot of moss in it. What would you recommend?
Well, it's just a drainage problem. Moss is an indicator that it's not draining. And most lawns, if they're on clay, I don't know if you're on clay, but they never really take brilliantly on clay, that's for sure. But you can do a couple of simple operations to improve it. I'd spike it. So I'd get a board of fork, I'd go over it and spike it at regular intervals, nice and deep. Then I'd probably you scarify it with your lawn rake, that's where that comes into play. And what you do, you drag that over the lawn and that just breaks all of the stole on the underground stems and it gets it to thicken. I figure if it's mild, I'll probably do a little bit of oversowing as well, thicken it up. And you can add a little bit of wildflower seed into that as well if you wanted to, if you wanted to make it diverse.
Still might just germinate. It's a bit late though, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. The thing is with grass is if it's over 5 degrees, it will go. So,
okay.
Yeah, so I think that if it just sits there, the only main problem with it is you might just have a 10 pigeons turn up.
Yes, well, I know. Cue Chris turning up with his water pistol.
Yeah, pump action water pistol.
Pump action water pistol, absolutely. So that's the grass taken care of. What about thinking around the flower beds and shrubs? And also, are you too late to put in perhaps hedgerow plants and things like that?
No, not at all. You can, I mean, then bare root, that's fine. You can do them any time during the dormant season. So if you want to put in a little hedge, a native hedge, then certainly you can put in bare root, small bare root saplings. As far as other things go, I will probably prune all my shrub, most of my deciduous shrubs. They're the plants that drop their leaves at the end of the summer. And what I'll do to look at them is I'll look at any dead woods, anything that looks like it's had it, and just thin them out. Like plants, just like us, they need aeration. They need air that circulates around them to keep healthy. So I'll be looking to do that. Things like herbaceous, I'll leave them in situ. I'll leave the dead foliage on. I love that strawy effect. If I do get a frost, it looks amazing. You get the silver frost for it. But also that protects the root ball and it provides habitat for wildlife as well.
Yeah. Okay. And thinking ahead to spring, did you put your bulbs in? Have you done your bulb?
I've done my bulbs. I put about, I think on the balcony, is about 320 bulbs went in. So it's going to be quite spectacular. Yeah, it is.
How is that even possible?
Is it? Well, I do a lot of lasagnas, or a lot of trifles, I should say. There's a lot of bulbs out there, basket and in the pots. I do have a little bit of trouble with squirrels. They've started to access the balcony because the overgrowth, the sycamores that are just off the balcony have got bigger, of course. The crown's got bigger so they can reach it. So I'll cut them back, but I tend to put down chicken wire over the baskets and the tubs, and that tends to deter them.
Yes, I found the same, actually. As long as I've got my bulbs in pots and a bit of chicken wire over the top, then once they're in the green, they don't mind.
They don't mind. They do love a hyacinth. I've seen them dig out hyacinths quite a lot. And so they will go for them, or crocus as well.
Yeah.
So you do need to protect. Yeah, you do.
Yeah. And there's a lot of squirrels around. And my final question is, I know it feels a bit early to be talking about this, but are you thinking ahead to any kind of interesting good garden Christmas gift?
Yeah. Christmas starts so early, doesn't it?
Yes.
Well, I'm thinking about it a bit, maybe for my good lady. I think I'll maybe give her, put up some amaryllis bulbs for her this year. Because they're pretty spectacular flowers, aren't they? So some, if I can, I try to make homemade stuff if I can. Some of that's, rather than just go down and there's so much tat out there, isn't
it? Yes, there is. When you plant an amaryllis bulb, do you do it in a vase? Do you do it in something where you can see the roots?
Well, you can do that. That's perfectly legitimate. But I tend to do it in a terracotta pot and I leave a little bit of the crown of the bulb showing. I'll probably put three in a pot for real spectacular. Yeah, but you can if you want to see that. You do that hyacinths as well. If you want to see that inside a glass vase, you can. I'm always a little bit worried that if you overwater, it might become waterlogged. That's I quite like the idea of being able to drain.
That's fair enough. And how long roughly from putting your bulb in your terracotta pot to actually getting a flower?
Well, it should be maybe around amaryllis if you put it in a nice sunny spot, 6 to 8 weeks, something like that.
Okay.
Hopefully
so
it'll be.
Crack on now and perfect for Christmas.
Or just after.
Another fantastic Christmas present, of course, would be a gift membership to Garden Organic.
Yes, that's certainly true.
Absolutely. And those are available on our website, and they do make a brilliant present because, of course, people get a lovely pack in the post that inspires them ready for spring.
Yes, of course. And it's a bargain, really, I think. It's an absolute great deal. So, and obviously the Heritage Scene Library as well, access to that. It's a great Christmas present. It really is.
It really is. Absolutely. Thanks ever so much, Chris. See you next time.
Cheers, Fiona.
In late August, I visited Orsa Gregers-Warg, head gardener at the beautiful Beth Chateau Plants and Gardens. As we talked, Orsa told me about the significance of preserving the garden's ethos while adapting to changing climates, the role of diverse planting in promoting resilience, and the unique challenges faced in this iconic landscape.
First of all, can you give me your name and your job title?
Orsa Gregers-Warg, head gardener, Beth Chateau's Plants and Gardens.
I'm standing in the gravel garden That is so famous and so well known here at the Beth Chatto Gardens. And I'm completely awestruck by it. It just is everything I imagined. And over the top of it is this enormous eucalyptus tree that must have been planted, I don't know, 40 years ago or so?
Approximately 40 years ago. It was planted just before the Gravel Garden was created in 1991-92.
So tell me what kind of possessed Beth to do something with a piece of gravel?
Well, you have to remember where we are in the country. So we're actually in one of the driest parts of the country with an average rainfall of about 500 millimetres per year or 20 and a half inches. And actually where we're standing, you got 5-6 metres of sandy gravel beneath your feet. That's the natural soil. So we've got lots of gravel pits in the area. And if Beth had gardened on a different type of soil, she wouldn't have decided to create a gravel garden. But she was absolutely convinced that she could make a beautiful garden and show people that you don't have to irrigate it as long as you choose the right plant for the right place.
That's really interesting, isn't it? She didn't wake up one day and decide to create a gravel garden. She looked at what she was given. She looked at the surroundings and the environment in which she found herself and then worked with it. I think you probably get a lot of questions, don't you, from visitors about how they can create a gravel garden. And it's certainly something I've thought about. What would you advise in the first instance?
Generally, we just advise that work with the environment and the growing conditions that you have got. Of course, you can, you know, raise a bed if you've got very heavy soil, and you can add grit and you can add rubble. But I think plants always do much better if you work with nature rather than trying to fight against it.
Okay, so let's have a little walk through. And it's set out in beds, and there's pathways between the beds. But actually, the beds themselves are really spacious. You can see lovely sort of rivulets of gravel between the plants. So they really breathe. They're more collections rather than beds, maybe.
Well, Beth was very keen to really show off the individual plants rather than cram everything together. She really wanted people to be able to appreciate the individual plants. We have a bone structure that we, you know, plant with cistus, bellotas, lavenders, but then we also have spaces in between those plants where we allow annuals and biennials and perennials to come up and sort of soften the palette.
Let's talk about the bone structure, because there's a few plants that are really beautifully repeated throughout the garden. So what would be those absolute sort of anchor point plants?
Well, you already mentioned the eucalyptus. Beth always talked about painting the sky, drawing your eye up to the sky. In this garden, we really want trees that don't cast too much shade. We also got a couple of Mount Etna brooms, Genista etnensis. We've got Coloriteria, the golden rain tree. So it's really important to have that layer. And then also the middle layer with a lot of taller cistus that are evergreen. And you talked about repetition. You know, that's really key to leading the eye through the design, through the borders. And that can be a particular plant or a color or a shape. Here we're looking at Stipa gigantea, the golden oat grass, which is sort of dotted throughout the garden. Same with Gaura, Lindheimeri. We've got lots of Rubascums. Earlier in the season, one of the key plants is Euphorbia caracas wolfenii. There's really lime green, zingy blooms that just brighten up the garden in early spring, together with anemones, bright red anemone fulgens, and the pastel colour anemone pavonina.
Palette is very kind of desert colours, you know, beautiful kind of silvery foliage, a lot of that late season grass that's turning yellow, but almost kind of silvery yellow. And it is a silver palette at this time of year almost, I would say.
It is. Earlier in the year, you have that lushness, a lot more green. This time, as you say, it's more washed out bleach colour palette, which you normally would have in areas in the Mediterranean region, for example. And then in winter, you have carpets of silver and green. You've got thyme, you've got the lamb's ear, You've got silvery bellotas with, you know, green sisters.
It's absolutely beautiful. It really is. There's also these surprising clumps of lushness in amongst this sort of late summer, you know, dry, silvery look. You know, suddenly then there's a huge clump of agapanthus and then this beautiful maroon sedum there. So there's these other little flashes of colour that you don't see at first, but you do see when you look more closely.
That's very true. But we are cutting some of the plants back. We're cutting the nepetas back, and then we get the second flash of flower again. We've got the gauras, which we keep deadheading. So again, you have those little white little butterfly-like blooms, which will go on into November.
So cutting is key, generally.
If something is really struggling, if any of the herbaceous perennials are struggling, we can cut them back. But also just regular deadheading will just keep the show going for much longer.
This garden is particularly famous for not being watered. And Beth wrote about it extensively, didn't she? That she would give a little bit of water right at the start if she'd just planted something. But after that, it was up to the plant. How does that pan out in reality? Do you water at all in the gravel garden?
No. As you said, we only water when we plant, and then the plants will have to survive on what comes from above. So we tend to plant in spring and autumn when there's more moisture in the ground. We'll water the plants in really well, and then we'll come back and check after a week or two. Occasionally, you'll have to give them a second drink of water. It's always important to water well rather than little and often. But usually once tend to be enough. The key is to plant smaller plants, younger plants. So pot size wise, it tends to be 9 centimeter or liter. Shrubs, we might go up to 3 or possibly 5 liter size pots.
Some real top tips there. Thank you. The gravel garden is just one of 5 areas that make up this extraordinary place. We're going to head down, completely changing the palette, changing the tone, changing the temperature, changing everything, because we're going to walk really only a few metres away into quite an extraordinary water garden. So we've come into the water garden, which is completely and utterly different. A lot of trees. So we've gone from a very sort of silver and yellow place to a very green and sort of gorgeously dark foliage is around us. There's something quite special about this water garden, which is that I think it's spring fed. Is that right?
Yes. And that's one of the reasons that Beth and Andrew decided to move to Elmstead Market, where Andrew had a fruit farm. So the garden was created on a piece of wasteland, but there was a spring fed ditch. So they knew that even in dry Essex, they would be able to create a garden where they could grow a very, very different range of plants. So both Mediterranean style plants, but also moisture loving plants.
And I mean, we're surrounded now by, you know, ferns and, you know, enormous gunneras. I'm going to let you describe them to us, because the thing that's so striking is that these plants have been allowed to become their full selves. They're not too pruned at all. Things are really naturalistic. So can you describe the kind of plants and trees we've got around us?
Well, the only trees that were here when Beth and Andrew moved here were the oak trees. So you have these lovely shapes of old oak trees. And then right where we're standing, we've got a swamp cypress and a dawn redwood, really sort of drawing your eye up to the sky. Wonderful silhouettes in the winter.
Will this redwood get enormous?
It's probably the tallest tree in the garden at the moment, but of course they won't get as large as they do in the native habitat. Beth called them her church spires. And if you come in winter, it's very flat around the ponds. And then just a few months later, in summer, you have these enormous gunneras. You've got the eupatoriums. In the ponds, you have thalia, pontederia. So very lush green foliage, lots of different textures and shapes and forms. Beth was always very keen on focusing on that rather than flower colour.
Ah, that's interesting. Form more than colour.
Form and texture and shape. So the planting should really look good, even if it's not in bloom.
Which it does. I mean, it really does. Whereas actually, we often talk about sort of the anticipation of waiting for things to come into bloom. That's not the point here.
Ideally, the plants will look great as they sort of burst through the soil in spring, you know, lovely buds. Flowers are obviously, you know, a real bonus, but beautiful foliage, and then ideally nice seed heads as well. But if you were to take a photograph in black and white of the garden, it would really stand out. So it's not so much about the flowers. It's really those sort of subtle nuances when it comes to textures and different colours and shades of green and brown.
Tell us a little bit about how you came to be here yourself.
So I'm from Sweden originally, and I got into horticulture, but I really, really wanted to work with someone who had created a beautiful garden, who was still alive, and a garden that was open to the public. The gardening season in Sweden is relatively short, and we just don't have these kinds of gardens, I have to say.
You talk about Sweden and gardening being very different there. You know, light levels play a part, temperature plays a part, I'm sure lots of other factors play a part. It's interesting to me that you wanted to come here to garden. What's special about gardening in the UK?
I think it's just such a fantastic gardening tradition. And also there's a, you know, huge range of, or a huge palette of plants to play with, which wouldn't necessarily be hardy in Sweden.
And we can certainly see the palette. But actually, from a Northern Hemisphere perspective, we're not that far away either.
No, but I'd say, you know, we're probably a couple of months ahead in the spring, a much longer growing season in the autumn as well. The grass tend to be, you know, green in winter, which never happens in Stockholm.
So when you met her, what do you think it was that sparked between you?
Well, I think we just had a very similar sort of ethos, and, you know, how we wanted to garden, the right plant, right place. It was just common sense to Beth and to me as well. But you don't often see that. Beth was so ahead of her time and really not trying to force plants into an area where they wouldn't naturally want to grow. But it was a combination of, you know, she had a fantastic eye for detail in the way she described plants. She really looked at them and observed them. She was a fantastic plants woman, but she also had the artistic side, you know, the way she put the plants together in such a beautiful, aesthetically pleasing way. And I think that's really what moved me. And it's just a very special feel to the whole garden, you know. It's a very sort of tranquil, beautiful place.
And the focus generally seems to be on perennial planting and trees, certainly in this part of the garden, not so many trees in the gravel garden, but in this part of the garden you've got a sense of permanence about it, but yet it must have always been under review, and she must have been changing things around and moving things around and those sorts of things, was she?
Of course, you know, she always used to say that a garden is not like a painting hanging on a wall. It's constantly changing, it's evolving. The garden is very different in one sense now, because a lot of the trees have matured. So where you used to have open, sunny areas with perhaps moist soil, the tree roots are now soaking up all that moisture, and the canopy of the tree is casting shade. So we can't go back and replant what Beth used to grow in that particular area. But then you have other trees that, you know, perhaps die of old age, and it just opens up a different window of opportunity to do something different. The main thing is really to stay true to Beth's ethos and philosophy and the feel of the garden, and then let the garden evolve naturally.
Beth and Andrew were quite a partnership and had sort of horticulture in their blood, really, didn't they? Although she wasn't trained, but he had a phenomenal knowledge, and between them, they amassed this extraordinary, you know, encyclopedic knowledge of the right plants for their garden. How much was Andrew involved?
Well, Andrew was really key. Although Beth was perhaps the more public persona out of the two, he was really instrumental in creating the garden. He was a fruit farmer by trade, but his real passion was at looking at where do garden plants come from in the wild? What plant communities do they grow in? So Beth could really go to him, and he would suggest and advise when it came to what plants, you know, would be suitable for the different areas of the garden, whereas she was the more creative, artistic one. So they worked really well together.
Yeah, And you can tell that, actually, just having read her books myself, there's a huge amount of mutual respect and sharing of knowledge and ideas. And they built this lovely house, which is right in the middle of the garden, very much in keeping a low house. You know, it's all about the garden. It's not about the house. It doesn't block anything. It's sort of an inverse of what normally happens. You know, people build a marvellous house and then put a garden around it. This is sort of the other way, isn't it?
Well, I think Beth spent most of her time outside. So this was really her passion. So the house is sort of Scandinavian style, 1960s style, with lovely views through those huge windows overlooking the water garden. But both Beth and Andrew preferred much to focus on the plants rather than actually the house.
We're standing under a giant gunnera. I think this is the closest I've ever been to such a magnificent gunnera. It's, you know, it's sending up its extraordinary kind of spikes, which I assume are its flowers or its seed heads.
That's the seed heads coming up. So gunnera is now on the invasive list. So it's not something we sell. So we make sure we're going to remove the seed heads, although it's never seeded around here. But obviously we grow it in a very responsible way.
Because of course it was very much a desirable garden plant not so long ago.
Absolutely. And I still think it's, you know, one of the most sort of intriguing and spectacular plants you can grow if you've got a damp soil. But with so many plants, as the climate is changing, we need to be responsible the way we garden.
Yeah, definitely. And what have you noticed here about climate change in general? You know, in some ways you think, well, a dry garden was very much sort of ahead of its time, which it was. But of course, it's not the only answer, is it? There are many things we have to consider. What are you noticing? What are you changing here in response to climate change?
I think it's just the unpredictability that we really noticed. We got very strong winds today, which, you know, we rarely used to have windy summers. We had a really wet winter, extremely wet. The gravel garden actually coped very well because it's so free draining. So all the water just drains through and the planting looked a bit lusher, but it wasn't really a problem. Whereas here in the water garden, where we grow moisture loving plants, we actually lost a couple of plants because the border behind us just got so waterlogged that some of the trees actually suffered and had to be removed. But I think generally it's, you know, new pests and diseases coming in as well. So it's not just climate change. I think we just need to look at more resilient plants. You know, anyone planting a new garden, tough, resilient plants is the way to go.
And have you any in mind? I mean, if you were thinking now I've got a gap in the gravel garden, what kind of plant would you suggest for that?
Again, it depends a little bit on the soil and where in the country you are, but plants with deep root systems like Baptisia, Thermopsis have done extremely well, you know, even during really dry, hot spells.
We also have to think about drought and the extreme heat that we've experienced in the last couple of years. What effect did that have on the garden?
It has really affected some of our trees, especially the amelanchiers that we grow. We lost most of our sorbus, the rowans. So we're looking to future-proof the garden. And this is now a mature garden as well. So some of the trees are already coming to the end of their natural lifespan. So we're really looking at finding something that can cope with possibly very cold winters, but also really hot summers.
We have had a walk around this morning and met some of the team, and I know that you are as sustainable as possible. You don't use any chemicals. You're not particularly certified organic, but you pretty much are organic. Would you say that's an important thing for you here?
Absolutely. And we haven't used any herbicides or pesticides for the last few years. While Beth was still alive, we used them sparingly, but always as little as possible. And we all have to be water wise these days as well. It started off with the gravel garden being the only part of the garden that was never irrigated. But since a couple of years ago, we don't actually water the rest of the garden either. I'm not saying that we're never ever going to water a plant in the garden if it's necessary. If we're planting a new shrub or tree, that might need a little bit extra help. But we're really conscious of, you know, how careful we have to be with our water resources in the future.
So we've just walked into the woodland garden, which is a really beautiful glade that is mostly oak trees. How many trees did Beth and Andrew plant in here, do you think?
Well, I'd say they probably added a couple of dozen trees. Some of them are no longer alive, but with any mature garden, you know, it does change. And the woodland garden is now much more open than it used to be. So there's a lot of more sunny pockets. So we're going to have to get a canopy back again. But also because it's such a dry, free draining soil and we no longer water, we really need to start adapting the other planting as well.
So you've planted underneath because there's a sort of understory going on. So what sort of plants have you planted underneath?
So the middle layer tend to be Amelanchier. We've got Philadelphus, Deutzia. We've had quite a few hydrangeas in the past, which are not necessarily suitable anymore. You've got a witch hazel, Corner's Mass. And then you've got the ground covers. So this is a beautiful garden in sort of late winter, early spring with the snowdrops starting off the season. And then you have the trilliums and erythroniums and hellebores. This time of the year is more of a quiet time. Just green carpets of vinca and ivy, symphytum, and this ground cover wine and clematis sort of sprawling across the surface.
It's a lovely kind of really naturalistic space. You know, it doesn't look like anybody planted anything deliberately. It really does feel as though it's always been here.
When Beth first created it, it was more of a tapestry. But over the years, we've allowed some of the plants to take over a little bit. And with such a small team, it's about, you know, 7.5, 8 acres we're looking after. And there's three of us full time, one part time and one apprentice. So we've just had to let the woodland kind of do its thing. Whereas we focus on maintaining the gravel garden, which is a different type of garden. And if you let the plants just self-seed there, it would just look very, very different. Whereas this really suits the woodland garden, I think.
We are just walking round to the reservoir garden. So the reservoir garden is completely different. I think you were dealing with, again, very different conditions. We're on a 7-acre site and we've gone from dry gravel sand to dry woodland to pretty moist wetland, and now we are somewhere in between all that. So describe the conditions here in the reservoir garden.
So the reservoir garden is sitting between the water garden and the woodland garden. So it's much higher up than the water garden. And the original soil was very much like the gravel garden, very free draining. When they excavated the reservoir, which was used to irrigate Andrew's fruit farm, it now belongs to the neighbouring farmer and he uses it for the same purpose. But all the clay that came up was actually used. Beth decided to spread it across the borders here, trying to make it a bit more moisture retentive. But it wasn't really mixed properly. So it would just turn into concrete in the summer and then be very, very wet and sticky in the winter. So when we redid this area, it was replanted in 2017. So we started preparing the soil a few years before that and added a lot of organic matter, mainly spent mushroom compost, and just trying to sort of break up the clay. But it's still quite a challenging soil. The main emphasis is really on herbaceous plants here, giving those plants on the nursery home that, you know, it might be too wet in the water garden or a little bit too dry in the gravel garden.
It's interesting because this speaks to me because it feels a bit more like some of the challenges that a lot of us have, where you might have a layer, you know, of clay, or, you know, you might have an area that you just feel you can't work it, you can't get it to do anything. And it sounds to me like this has been quite an experimental area of the garden.
It has been. And the first couple of years, some of the plants absolutely thrived. Some of the grasses, like Miscanthus and Molinias, did very well. And then we had two very, very hot, dry summers. And those grasses really struggled. So we're now replacing them with more drought-tolerant alternatives. But it's trial and error. It gives us an opportunity to really look for those resilient plants and sort of come up with a palette that we'll then be able to recommend to customers in the future.
When something doesn't work, what happens next?
Well, we can try a plant once or twice, but if it doesn't work, we're really looking for good garden-worthy plants that perform well. But that just gives us the opportunity to try something different.
We're just about to approach the final of the gardens, and it's the Scree Garden. It's actually a bit of a replication in a way of the gravel garden because it's the same soil type. But actually, Beth had very different ideas about this garden. It's right next to the house. Can you describe it? Because I think it really is very special.
So it's a series of raised beds. And after Beth created the gravel garden, she noticed that some of those smaller alpine plants got trodden on in the gravel garden, or you would simply notice them. So by planting them in these raised beds, it's more like a little jewellery box with, you know, little gems that you can appreciate. And it's also very relatable, I think, for most, you know, home gardeners that, you know, you can take a piece of this home with you and recreate something similar.
It's all in miniature. It's really inspiring, actually, because, yes, you could create something yourself and take a bit home. But actually, also, it shows them off. I mean, these tiny plants that could so easily just be overlooked. I wonder if we could name a few, actually, if you could give us a little quick plant tour here.
So we've got several different types of alpine saxifrage. You've got Origanum buckland, erodiums, in a creamy white erodium, ground covering teucrium, with that really little delicate silvery foliage and those sort of dusky mauve flowers, some of the smaller dianthus, euphorbia mercenitis, which we also grow in the gravel garden, euphorbia rigida, which is more upright.
And these plants are all, once again, planted with lots of gravel around them. And what I mean by that is that each plant kind of sits in its own little area, so they're not all crammed together. So you really, really can appreciate them individually. And then they are obviously very happy because they're happily self-seeding around the place, but not in a way that is intrusive or invasive, just in a really, just a charming way. I mean, this beautiful little verbascum that's just popped up on the edge of the bed. There's just something very personal about it. That's how it feels. It feels very personal.
Well, I think when we talk about weeding here, it's editing. It's really, you know, painting a picture of the plants. So when you say that, you know, it's not too many self-seeders that take over, that's partly because the garden team has recently spent a day or two here just weeding out those little tiny seedlings as well. But yes, we want to soften the edges of the borders, and we want plants to be able to self-seed and just pop up and appear. That's part of the charm, I think, of the garden.
I would really like to finish with reflecting back on Beth and what you think her legacy is and what it is that you are so proud to curate now.
She was always very keen. She was a keen teacher. And, you know, we want to be able to bring the garden, you know, into the future, but also the message, the right plant, right place. We're working with some of the more external projects at the moment, bringing sustainable gardening outside of the garden. So we're working with a housing development next door to us, where we're actually planting in sand. It's showing people that you don't have to have lawns, that you need to irrigate and feed and cut. You can have a beautiful, low maintenance garden, which is also great for biodiversity. We created another garden in Colchester near First Sight out of Rabble, planting into that. And it's just sort of inspiring and giving people ideas and showing that it's not actually difficult to create a beautiful garden.
I think the abiding message from one of her books that I read, which was The Garden Notebook, and her message was, if you want to do something, just have a go. If you think you've got a creative streak in you and you want to explore that, what's stopping you? And it was a really powerful message for me and set me on a certain path, especially with gardening. And I think she had far more influence on far more people than she would have ever realised. And it's one thing to become well known and sort of be, as it were, on the circuit, which to an extent she was. But actually, it's quite another thing to be able to reach people on such a personal level. And I think that really is what this garden now can do. And what a legacy.
It's a fantastic legacy and a huge responsibility as well.
Thank you very much, Ulsa. It's been great talking to you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for coming.
Time now for the post bag. I'm here with Chris and Anton. And the first question is one that I love because it's all about reusing old compost. So Dillis has written in and said, what's the best way of reusing old grow bag compost, which has been used to grow tomatoes and cucumbers? Anton, what would you recommend?
So once compost's been used for a season, it will be pretty devoid of nutrients. The plants are pretty heavy feeders, both tomatoes and cucumbers, so they'll have used up most of the nutrients. Also, you'll find it has slumped quite a bit. It's lost a lot of its structure. Personally, I tend to put it on my sort of ornamental and flower beds. I think that's the best use of it. It is possible to reuse it, but you will need to replenish those nutrients. So you could add some of your own compost. You probably want to add about a third of your own compost to the mix. You really need to recharge those nutrients. That will also help to improve the structure as well.
Is there any mileage in hanging on to it until the spring and using it as a seed compost? Would you recommend that? Because we always talk about seed compost needing very few nutrients.
So personally, that's something I wouldn't do because the structure wouldn't be that great for sowing seeds. Also, seedlings are quite disease prone. Things which bigger plants can survive, your seedlings seem to be a lot more fussy about. So things like the damping off, so that's when your seedlings just sort of horribly all seem to keel over.
Yes, all at once.
Yeah. And that's quite demoralising. Yeah. So I would actually spend my money on some good seed compost for that. I'd probably be using it to mulch my flower beds.
Yep. Okay. Very wise. Okay. We're going to move into the orchard now. The question is, I have 4 apple trees and every year we suffer the effects of codling moth. Can you advise me on how to manage this pest? And that was Tom who wrote in with that. You're also interested in this question, aren't you, Chris?
I am indeed, because I've just taken over the management of an old orchard, quite an old one, in South London, and it's got a lot of codling moth. Now, traditionally, I remember from my younger days, traps. You'd set traps in the trees. I always remember the triangle sort of trap to bring in, I think it's the male codling moth. I'm sure Anton will tell me more about it, but it's quite bad, and I'm quite wondering what I could do about it, because it's one of those things, it's quite a difficult thing to treat, isn't it, Anton?
Yeah, it is. So you're probably not likely to notice the actual moths themselves, but what you will find, it's really the traditional sort of maggot in the apple, although it is actually a caterpillar. And what you'll first notice is just like a little hole. And often this hole's just at the opposite end of the stalk, so you can't actually see it very well because it's sort of quite well concealed. And then when you bite into the apple, you'll suddenly see this horrible sort of trail. If you're really unlucky, you'll actually find the maggot still in there. But if you're not quite so unlucky, you'll find a big sort of trail of brown bits where it's eaten its way, and also a lot of frass, which is caterpillar poo.
Yep.
So it doesn't improve the apple by any means.
And when does it pounce on the apples?
So the females start laying their eggs sort of early summer, June, July, just when the apples are starting to form. And then the caterpillar comes out of the apple in late summer and then just hangs out on the tree all winter as a sort of dormant caterpillar.
Oh, right. So when does it turn into a moth?
It pupates in early spring.
Right.
So, it's quite a strange life cycle.
Long period.
Long pupation, yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. And is it just apple trees or other fruit trees?
So it can get pears as well. And then there's also a plum moth, which is really quite similar. It's not quite the same, but you'll get a similar
sort of effect.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, blimey. So you've got this too, Chris. Yeah.
Yes, I have. There's a lot of it there. It's an old orchard. I was wondering about whether hygiene would make a difference, clearing up dead leaves, or maybe the crowns are very dense and I've got to give them all a big prune. Would that help if I cut all the dead wood out, moving air through it, or would that make no difference at all?
I think the sweeping up the leaves might help a bit because the caterpillars can reside around there as well. I'm not that sure about the pruning, really, because they sort of live in the scales of the bark quite often. The caterpillars find little places to hide out, so they'll even be on the sort of main stem of the tree, so you're unlikely to...
Are there any predators that might go after them?
Yeah, there are quite a few birds would go after.
So if you encourage bird, if you put bird feeders in and bird houses, that might reduce the amount.
Definitely, yeah, that will help. I mean, quite a lot of people just end up tolerating a low level of them, you know.
So to understand how we treat them then, organically, give us the rundown. Obviously, we've talked about encouraging a good bird population, removing the leaf litter, but are there other methods you can adopt to try and control this?
If you've just got a few apple trees, you can try using pheromone traps, but their effectiveness is quite limited. They're mainly used more for just monitoring how many are there, but if you've just got a few trees, they might reduce the numbers because it sort of lures the males away, so there's less eggs get laid. But if you've got more apple trees around, then there'll be plenty of more females coming in to lay their eggs. The other things you can do is using nematodes, and so those are little tiny worms which attack the caterpillars, and you need to apply them when it's still sort of quite warm and humid. The time to apply them is either in September or April time, when it just before the caterpillar pupate.
So right now the best thing you can do is clear up your leaf litter underneath set some bird feed out, but actually you can't really take action until the spring.
That's right. And if you look on, there's loads of websites which have advertised sort of biological control for coddling moths. You don't need to remember the Latin name for the biological control, because I'm not sure I can either.
Just as well.
But just look up online and you'll see something.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. Final question from Emma. I've read that I should avoid leaving my soil bare over the winter. Why is this, and how should I protect it? Chris, can you explain, first of all, why it's important not to have bare soil?
Well, there's a few reasons, really. Soil structure being the main one. Obviously, if you get heavy rains, etc., we don't tend to, where I am in London particularly, we don't tend to get frosts anymore, which will break the soil up. It's more likely to heavy rains, and then you get a capping, so the water runs off and you get damage, but also mainly leaching as well. So if water moves through soil, it will take the nutrient with it and wash it down to the subsoils, etc. So by protecting it, I keep those nutrients up in the top of the soil where I want them to be for my cropping.
What do you then use to cover those patches?
Well, I can use a few things. I might use cardboard, literally just cardboard if I can. If I've got it, I'll use leaf mould. I'm quite sparing with that because it takes so long to break down, but suddenly some sort of protection to stop that the top of the topsoil getting any kind of damage.
Okay. Anton, you're a big green manure expert. Are we a bit too late for green manures in November?
I think so, really. I mean, at a pinch, you could try growing field beans, but I mean, the germination is going to be pretty slow at that time. And actually, field beans works out quite expensive because the seed's quite big, so you need quite a lot of them. And I think really you're chucking your money away because you're sowing something that's quite pricey and that's probably not going to germinate very well. That's the problem with green manures, is that you do need to
be on it. You've got to be thinking
timing,
about it.
Isn't it?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah. Sort of August, September time, you've got to really be thinking about it, haven't you? Yeah. We often talk about mulching. It's a big, big subject for this organisation. We love our mulch. We often talk about mulching with garden compost. Again, is that advisable this time of year?
Personally speaking, I am a mulcher in the early spring, sort of early Marchish time. And there's a reason for that, really. I think if you put good quality compost down, it's going to have a lot of nutrient in it. Again, the same problem. I'll bring back leaching. If it's raining, that's going to get washed through and you're going to lose all that nutrient. So coming from the point of view that the compost is our black gold, if you like.
Yeah.
I like to be very sparing with it, but I like to use it at the right time. And I think if you're putting on compost in March, the soil's starting to warm, all the organisms and the worms, etc., are going to pull that compost into the soil, and you're not going to lose. You'll benefit from it massively.
Yeah, okay. Fully understand. So really, this time of the year, it's more about covering the soil.
Protection.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Is there any benefit to leaving weeds in situ? I've got plenty of them. Anton?
Yeah, I think it's a great thing to leave some weeds. I mean, basically, it's a free green manure. It's just doing the same job as a green manure, but you haven't had to pay for the seed. So.
Some of them are quite nice. Like things like speedwell are quite common. I get on my allotment, and that keeps flowering in the winter. You'll see the odd flower on it, and it doesn't do much harm. It's quite easy to remove. Chickweed's another one. The only thing I'd avoid is probably like yourself, pernicious weeds like my horsetail, my bindweed, my couch grass. I don't really want them to overwinter because they'll get away nice and early in the spring. But anything else, exactly right. Why? If it's not doing any harm, let it sit there and let it protect your soil.
I think the challenge is going to be on allotments when you've got the allotment aficionados coming round and with a clipboard and telling you that you haven't kept your plot tidy. But hopefully people are being a little bit more relaxed over things
like that. I think maybe people are a bit more understanding of biodiversity and troubles with pollinators and stuff. So hopefully, yeah, but you're right. It depends. It's a lot. Look, we said before, allotments are microcosms of humanity. So if you get the wrong committee, you mean weeds out. You know what I mean? So it just depends, isn't it, on the site you're on. But I mean, nothing wrong with a bit of speedwell, is there? It's a nice little plant.
Having said that, a lot of weeds do break the rules as well. They don't sort of look in a textbook to say where they're going to go. You'll find them sort
they're colonisers, aren't they? They move in where we don't go. And so,
opportunists. Yeah, definitely. But a great way to observe your garden and to see what's going on. And from my point of view, the idea of not having to pull up weeds during the winter is just brilliant. That's made my day. All right. Well, thanks very much. That's all we've got time for. Thanks, both of you.
Thanks, Fiona.
See you next month.
On the next podcast, I'll be chatting with gardener and food writer Rachel de Tampel all about her latest recipe book titled Winter Wellness. With Christmas just around the corner, now's the perfect time to consider a Garden Organic gift membership. Not only will your loved one gain access to a wealth of gardening resources, but this year, every gift membership includes a Seed Ball matchbox. Seed Ball is on a mission to help increase the abundance of British wildflowers and the wildlife that depend on them. Founded by conservation scientists Dr. Anna Attlee and Dr. Emily Lambert, Seed Ball aims to fill the world with colourful wildflowers starting in your own garden. Find out more by visiting seedball.co.uk. To purchase Garden Organic membership as a gift, you can visit gardenorganic.org.uk/join us. Do send us in your organic gardening questions. You can contact us via our website or social media. We're at Garden Organic UK on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and LinkedIn. Thanks again to our sponsors, Viridian Nutrition, and to Kevin MacLeod for the music. That's it. Till next time.